My computer does have different colors. That's proof. We'll have to see if the new colors work. The dark one, I think it's hard to read, so we'll see how that goes. You can let me know. That is the way that you all can help edit my sermons. You can help me choose colors. Other than that, I don't want your help at all. No, I'm just joking. It's a good day. It's really good for all of us to be here together. Snow days are special. They just are, and there's something really exciting about everything being changed because of horrible or wonderful weather, and we're still working hard to be here together, and I think that's just such a good thing. The daily Bible reading this week was started in Matthew 1 through 5, and so I wanted to do a lesson that's not even all of Matthew chapter 5. Just looking at the Beatitudes, and I have one slide about salt and light, so you can tell just where this sermon is going to be. When I made the handout, there was no way that I could get it down to 8 slides, so it's 10 slides, and I just chopped off the first one and the last one. So your handout won't have the one about salt and light, and it doesn't have this one up front. And I didn't write the Beatitudes, so that's why it wouldn't fit. The reason I don't do more than 8 slides on a PowerPoint is I'd have to start stapling the handouts, and that's just work, and I'm not going to do that. But hopefully we're going to talk about something that you know and that you've been thinking about on your own. I think the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5 in particular, just one of the greatest moments in history is when Jesus preaches this lesson and shares these ideas. If you take the time to memorize the Beatitudes, you're going to see them everywhere, and in particular in the New Testament, the idea of who is blessed, what ideas are the right ideas, and who is going to be able to get ahead spiritually. Not maybe get ahead in this world, but get ahead spiritually. But the Sermon on the Mount is a sermon about the citizens of God's heavenly kingdom. That's what all of chapters 5 and 6 and 7 is. It is our constitution. It is what we are. It describes us. It gives us a game plan. It helps us to think. And it's about a people who are looking for things that the world is not interested in. We look and behave differently. We are interested in things that are undesirable in the world. In fact, what the world is interested in, Jesus in this sermon says, don't get interested in that. And so it's very much about, from the worldly perspective, the sermon is backwards. It's upside down. It's about a kingdom that's going to provide the absolute, consummate happiness. It's about how to be blessed, or depending upon where you are in your reading, blessed. It's hard to say. Blessed are the poor in spirit. We ought to say blessed are the poor in spirit because it rolls off the tongue in a beautiful way that way. But it's about having this great happiness being a part of that kingdom. And it's about a kingdom that's going to provide a full happiness that we're not going to fully see here and now. It is a hereafter idea that we have a taste of. And it's a sermon, not my sermon, Jesus' sermon, that reveals the spiritual qualities that we need in our lives. It's going to put some paradoxes and some things in a backwards order. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit. That's not the way this globe seems to work, but Jesus is telling us that it actually is the other way around, and it is those who are meek who will inherit. And so that is what's going on in this whole sermon. And I just want to start taking the time to look at the Beatitudes. Let's go ahead and read. I'll start in Matthew 5, and I'm just going to read 1 through 12. Just read through the Beatitudes, and then we'll talk about them together. Well, I will talk about them to you. We'll think about them together. Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 1. Seeing the crowds, he went up onto a mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. So he has this theater. It's almost like a reverse theater. He's speaking down the mountain. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is just fabulous ideas here. Little sentences that are packed with a lot of things to think about. I think it's fun to do this as a beginning of the year lesson. We should probably study the Beatitudes once a month and think about what's going on here. Blessed are the poor in spirit, to be poor, to be empty or lacking in the spirit. This is that disposition or that influence. And I did a bunch of lessons on spirit. It's the same word, spirit. This is someone who is empty or lacking in this maybe drive or desire or that which would fill a person up. What is it that we are poor in? I love this line in Psalm 51, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. I don't think that means we need to take spiritual people and break them. But when we are someone who recognizes who and what we are, the reality should wake us up to realize that we are lowly, poor, or broken spirits. When we spent the time this morning thinking about who Jesus was, and he kept getting higher and higher and higher as we were reading through the book of Revelation, and then his sacrifice became that much lower and lower and lower. That's merely trying to get our minds wrapped around who Jesus is. The same effort around our own selves isn't going to inflate ourselves, but it ought to help us recognize how low and poor we are. I don't think that this means that we're just completely spiritually destitute and that we're a mess, but it's rather a recognition of our own inability, I think. Spiritually bankrupt is a phrase that I've heard before, and that can be okay, but it's this idea of recognizing who and what we are. And I like to think about these two different individuals who were both very confident in the same parable. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, or some translations, I love it, thus to himself. God, I thank thee that I am not as the rest of the men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, and even as this publican. God, thank you for me. And he's praying to himself, and then there's the publican or the tax collector standing afar off, wouldn't lift much as lift up his eyes into heaven, but smote his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Now, what are they confident in? What are they sure of? Okay, with the first guy, who cares? The second guy is absolutely confident and sure in what his state was. So which one is the saved one? I think that this is such an interesting idea. This tax collector who knew that he was low and knew that he was a sinner is the one who is saved. Okay, there's all the processes about what do we need to do to reach out to God and baptism and salvation and all that. But the words of the saved one are the words, be merciful to me, a sinner. That doesn't mean that we're going to walk around recklessly. But there's this understanding, this poor in spirit, that I need God. Theirs is the kingdom. There's this sense that we own or have. I put own in quotation marks. I don't know what the right word is there. But we've got it. God's kingdom. It's in hand. What does that do to you? If you have the kingdom of heaven in hand, and you wake up on Monday morning and have to go to the office, and it's the office, but you've got the kingdom of heaven with you. Who cares what Mondays are like? These things won't matter. We are going to be fine. When we read in Matthew 13 about the man who is wandering around in a field and he finds the treasure, nothing in life matters. He sells everything he can to have that treasure. Or the man who wants and knows the right kind of pearl, and he spends all of his days looking for that right pearl. We have, when we recognize how low we are, we have the kingdom in hand. And I think that that is a beautiful and exciting idea. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. But not every sad person gets comfort. That's true. It's not that's the way the world works. Jesus talked to a guy, told a guy exactly what he needed to do to be with God, and when the young man heard that, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. I don't think Jesus went, whoa, I guess my beatitude is wrong. There is something about mourning, and there is something about comfort that didn't line up with this man. Jesus is offering him the comfort that he needs, but that man did not want that. He wanted the comfort of money or the safety and security of those riches and money. That's not what Jesus was offering. Get rid of those riches and you can have the comfort that you want. But that's not what I'm mourning about. I'm mourning about not having enough riches. And so we can see how there's this problem here. We need to be careful about what we are mourning and sorrowing for. We know in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 that the God of all comfort is going to comfort us. And we love that passage because it's even hilarious how many times the word comfort shows up. So it's not that God is reckless and pushing people around. But there's this idea that's introduced here. Those who mourn will be comforted, and we need to think about what does it mean to mourn and mourn what about and how and why. There's just such a strong idea about mourning for the right things. Did Adam and Eve mourn? I don't know. I don't know if I see that in the story. And isn't that curious? They hid, they were afraid, they were ashamed. I don't know if that means they did not mourn. But I don't see mourning in the story as revealed by God. What about Cain? Did he mourn when his brother died? Did he mourn over his, oops, I should not have murdered him? Did he mourn when God punished him? Or why did he mourn? And so we can see that there's a mess here. There's sorrow and then there's incorrect sorrow. And we talk about that in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Godly grief produces repentance that leads to salvation without regret. There's a beautiful, powerful picture in Ezekiel 9. Destruction is going to come. This town is doomed, but there's a lot of people who recognize that this town is full of sin. So God sends out a man to put a mark on everyone's forehead who is upset by what they see. And I think that that points to what we ought to be thinking about. Mourning for our own sin, mourning for the sin that we see in others. We can think about being the peacemakers that is coming out later, or being meek, as it's going to come up later. There's this connection, how they all mix together. But Jesus is the one who does give comfort. In Luke chapter 7, let's turn there and look at that real quick. This is one of those sermons, literally, I could do for a few hours and fill up the usual Sunday 3-hour time slot. I'm trying not to go too slow. Jesus goes over to the Pharisee's house for dinner. And the Pharisee, and this lady comes up and she's crying and washing Jesus' feet. And in Luke 7 and verse 39, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. Jesus tells the parable, and at the very end, verse 44, do you see this woman? I entered your house, and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. And then here, he has these two statements to this woman. He said to her, your sins are forgiven. And then in 50, he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. That is who Jesus comforted. Now, his words provided comfort for the Pharisee, if the Pharisee is listening. But that's what Jesus wants to give us. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This is my favorite one. I love to think about this word. I think it's really interesting and counterintuitive in the Bible, meekness, mildness of disposition, gentleness. Sometimes this word is translated gentle. A lot of times in the New Testament, it will be translated gentle, but never in this because we all memorized it King James style. But there's other times when this word shows up and it's translated to be gentle. There's this willingness. And in particular, it's going to be willing to let God, but it's going to show up in others as well. For the slide, I'm putting it willingness to allow God to take care of our problems. There's a big, big connection here with our church family that I'm going to be willing to let you help me with my problems. That requires a tremendous amount of meekness in me. I don't know how you boast about how meek you are. Wow, look at all my meekness. I let you take care of me. But we don't want help so much of the time. Allowing others to do, allowing God to avenge, not taking it on our own, but letting God. There's a lot of self-control demanded in this idea of meekness. Jesus is one who is meek and lowly in heart. And that ESV translated gentle. I've heard Scott say it this way. Not weak and lowly. There's a lot of people who are weak and lowly, but there's a big difference between someone who is weak and lowly and someone who is meek and lowly. There is this restraint, this on-purpose decision to allow the thing to be. And that's hard. That's hard. It's comfortable to try to control other people. When my life feels out of control, if I can just get you under control, then I'll feel safe. Well, that's not meekness. That's living life backwards. And so this is a very powerful one. Living in a dog-eat-dog world, we need to live with meekness. And if we do, we will inherit the land. Meek shall inherit the earth. It got translated that way in the King James translation. We'll never change it because everyone's going to be grouchy if we read it another way. But it just, you know, the word earth and land and dirt and soil, you know, all these interchangeable ideas, and they can be all connected that way. In Psalm 37, there's a lot of inheriting the land. There's a lot of times where the people who are doing the right things in Psalm 37 will inherit the land, and the meek shall inherit the land. Psalm 37 is very big about that. It's worth taking a look at this idea of what am I going to do to inherit the land? Either some land here on earth, possibly, but I think it's the land hereafter. In Revelation chapter 2, this is I think it's the message to Sardis. I can't remember for sure. Revelation chapter 2, this is a hard message about those who are going to, it's Smyrna, not Sardis, those who are going to suffer. They are poor, but they're rich. They need to not fear what they're going to suffer. Behold, the devil's about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. 10 days, that's a long time. 7 is the complete number in the book of Revelation. This is going to be a little bit longer than that, but it's only days. So it's going to be long, but not unendurable. Be faithful unto death. How meek do you have to be in order to allow yourself to die? Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown, not of victory. Yes, victory. There's others. But if you are faithful to death, you get the crown of life. Do you see the opposite there? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the land. Be faithful unto death, and you'll be alive, is what Jesus is trying to communicate to us. It's a big, powerful idea that we need to think about. Blessed are those who huger and thirst for righteousness. This is a modern translation. I was in a rush. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Righteousness is a really fun word to think about. I love the question in a Bible class, what does righteousness mean? Describe it or define it. And this, kind of rightness, and that's about the definition. It's a hard word to describe when you're reading the... I'm pulling this out of one of the Bible definitions that I found of the Greek word. It's that state of a person when they're the way they're supposed to be as a person. rightness. I mean, it's a weird word. We all know what it is. We go to church and we know it, but then describing it's really hard. It's really interesting to think about. And that's what we're hungering and thirsting after, the condition or the state of being acceptable with God. And I don't know, there's other aspects of righteousness. That's the righteous thing, or that one has righteousness. So there's my own righteousness and the righteousness of others, or that the church is going to be in righteousness. There's all these different ways. And so we're hungering and we're thirsting after that, that I would be that way. And I'm hungering and thirsting after that for myself. And I'm hungering and thirsting after it that you will be that way, as well as all of us together. There's a hunger and there is a desire that way. And we need to consider this the way we hunger and desire for all the junk that we should not have or even must not have. And that's the way that we need to hunger for this. We're not supposed to love the world or the things of the world. We're supposed to love righteousness and the things of righteousness. And it's hard to get ourselves turned around, but that's what we need to do. We need to be desiring and thinking for God's stuff, or the way God would want it to be, or what my life ought to be. And it needs to be that way, you know, at all the different moments of the day. It's going to affect the way I need to hunger and thirst after righteousness when I'm dealing with somebody that I don't care for. I need to hunger and thirst after righteousness when I am dealing with someone that I love a lot. I need to hunger and thirst after righteousness when I want to hit that snooze button again, but I have responsibilities. And what am I if I'm ignoring my responsibilities? Am I shining the light of the Lord as I ought to be? So it gets down into every little moment of our day. It's an important thing to think about. And it's the only way that we will have any satisfaction in life. We can't get satisfaction without it. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Find Psalms and go to the right. It's after Proverbs. I have verse 10 up here, but 10, 11, and 12 are great for this. The word satisfied literally means to feed with grass or to fill a person up. And then the bigger idea of satisfying one's desire. It's like a feeding your animals word. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled up with grass. I think that's a really interesting idea. And it doesn't, that's maybe the base and the literal word. Well, we're going to have this filled up feeling when that's what we hunger after. Because Ecclesiastes 5:10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Ecclesiastes 5 through 12 could be written by anyone who doesn't know about God, right? You hear people talk this way while they're still pursuing their money. I like the book of Ecclesiastes because it says things that are so spiritually true and connected to God, the divine one who gave us these little these real words. But people who don't believe in God can read that and go, yeah, that makes sense. Anything that we are using to fill the hole in our life is not going to fill that hole. And there are some hurts that God may not completely fill, but we can have satisfaction in life because of God and what he provides for us. We will only find satisfaction in God and what God provides. Read Psalm 78 on your own. It's a biggie. I should probably do a sermon about it. It's a great psalm, and it talks through some stories of the Israelites and their history, and there's a section, I think it starts in 17, it goes through 31, and I have verse 30 here. Where is God? Are we going to have any food? Where is God? Are we going to have anything to drink? And then they start getting some food and they get some drink. Well, where is God? What, can we even have some nice food that we like more? We know that story of the Israelites, and the psalm is talking through some of those moments. And God gives them that food, and they have the food in hand. And before they had satisfied their craving while the food was still in their mouths, the destruction came and started killing them. It's a fabulous story. And Psalm 78 retells it in a powerful way. Just when you get what you want, it hurts you. But blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. If I'm hungering and thirsting after food, all I'll have in my life is hunger and thirst. But if I hunger and thirst after righteousness, I can get that. I don't even know what that means. I can be like fully righteous. I don't want to boast about that, but there's this action or this idea that we can have satisfaction in God. And so we need to develop good eating habits. We need to figure out how to hunger after things that we're not naturally hungry for. I don't know if anyone ever, looked at a Brussels sprout for the first time in their life and said, I want that. You got to work up to it. And so there are spiritual things that we look at and we think, how is being meek going to get me? How am I going to survive in the world being meek? And we have to build our hunger for those sorts of things and get better at that day in and day out. And we need to be merciful. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. This is this idea of showing and having compassion or pity on somebody, right? The Samaritan, he's passing by, and he stopped, and he helped the man who was on the road. And Samaritans and Jews don't have any dealings with each other. I wonder if the guy who was so beat up on the road, if he was conscious enough, would have said, please don't help me, you're a Samaritan. That's a part of the story that I always wonder about. But being merciful, this active compassion, it's motivated by the fact that we ourselves have received mercy. We give and we give because we have received. Matthew 18 is that powerful story of the unmerciful servant who is forgiven so much by his master and turns around and is not merciful to another. The other servants see that and they tell on him. Tattletales are, you're not supposed to be a tattletale. They tell on him. They report this to God because it is that bad and that vile. And you don't want anyone to tell on you to God because you have not been merciful to those who are around you. We have to act in this way. Jesus, in his great act of mercy, gave himself up for us. Gave everything of himself up for us. And this is where we're going to find mercy. I don't trust the mercy in the world. I've had good friends who are good people. And I have to use the word good in context of the out there. Because it's not always dependable. Something may happen in our environment or in their life, and it's going to go up. But God is dependable, and his children are dependable. We stumble sometimes, but we can have a dependability because we are depending on God together. Worldly mercy grows in capricious circumstances. It's nourished by selfish desires. We're going to send money to this problem of the world, a new one shows up, and we're going to forget about that one. That's the way human beings are. It's fed by just selfishness or what's fancy in the moment. One thing I think it's important to think about, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. We need to recognize that we need mercy ourselves. You need to hunger for mercy. If you don't need mercy, you're wrong. You're just wrong. There's something in your life that you're not looking at honestly. And so when the man is beating his breast, saying, God being merciful to me, a sinner, he's admitting and he's acknowledging. That doesn't mean that he has to walk around sinning all the time. But he's admitting and understanding that he needs God's mercy. And we need to get it into our own hearts that we need God's mercy every day. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. The pure, those who are through and through, 100%, in everything they are and everything they do, this pure heart, it shows up in our own self-control. Flee useful passions, youthful passions. At the end of that verse, those who are doing this who are calling upon the Lord from a pure heart. So when we call on the Lord with a pure heart, we are going to do the things that Paul was telling Timothy to do. If you're doing those things, they demonstrate that you have this pure heart. And you're washing all your foods so you don't get any diseases in you. And Jesus says, yeah, but it's what's coming out of the heart that's more important than what's going into the body. You need to be so concerned about how pure your heart is. And so our heart is going to demonstrate itself, because it's either going to come out pure or come out corrupted. So what does it mean to be pure in heart? Does it mean to be sinless? Good grief. The man who's beating his breast saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, he might not sin for 5 minutes or 5 days. Does that mean he's sinless? I like the idea of sincerity, this pure heart, this single sight, this understanding that God is the way, and I'm focusing my heart on him in that way. Whereas the Pharisee said, I thank you that I'm awesome. He couldn't see, or he wouldn't see. What does it mean that we're going to see God? Well, at the end of Revelation, it says that we're going to see his face. That's really exciting. And so it could be, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall at the end see God. But there's a lot of ways I think that we can see God or see in a godly way or recognize the good that is out there. Seeing with the clear eyes, having this if your eye be single, the old translation there in Matthew 6 that I like, we will have our whole body full of light. I don't know exactly what it means to see God, if we're going to be looking at him or looking like him. I like to think about that one a lot. So you can get back to me what you think about that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. This continuous effort for unity and peace, something that's always available in God. So as far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. But because of God, we're going to have peace. So it's an interesting balance here. So those who are trying to make peace... It's something that we have access to in God. Peace is a thing that is, right? We've been united, Ephesians chapter 4, and we are eager to maintain that unity. The unity is, the peace is, and we're eager to maintain it. But in this world, peace is not going to look like that. In this world, peace is kind of dependent on the other person. I'm trying to peace, and if they don't accept it, there won't be peace. So I think it's more than the peace on earth that people are talking about. I think it's more than blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are those who stub their toe, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the peacemakers. It is probably meaning more than merely getting along with people. I think it's getting along with God, which leads us to be able to get along with God and others. In Galatians chapter 3, at the end of the chapter, for in Christ Jesus you are all sons of God through faith. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither slave nor free. There is no male and female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. Sons of God, at peace with God, at peace with each other. There's no difference. There's no race or gender differences. We're all together in one. We come from different backgrounds. Male and female are differences. But we are all sons of God together, working on this peace that God himself makes, and we are working to maintain it. And then we come to the end. Go back to Matthew chapter 5 and look at this. We're going to wrap it up with two ideas here. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's how it all began. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. What are the similarities between the two? I think that's really interesting. Blessed are the poor in spirit. I'm recognizing myself. Blessed are those who are persecuted. They're recognizing me. Maybe there's something there. But those are the ones who have the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Who would persecute the lovely people in these verses? Someone is meek. You might take advantage of them because you can get something out of them. Why would you persecute them? Someone is merciful. Why would you persecute anyone like that? Why would the world do that? It's because the world when seeing the light coming into the world, loved the darkness anyways, and fled the light because they did not want their deeds to be exposed, and they stayed in the darkness. Jesus says, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. It doesn't have to be logical. It doesn't have to make sense. Would you feel better if the persecution made sense? But persecution is what it is. And what is the fruit of persecution? There's this transformation and the strengthening. James tells us that we will be complete, perfect and complete. We are not whole until we've been beat. And whatever that word beat means, until it's hurt, until it's been hard, we're not complete. That's part of what makes us who we are. Christ incarnate on earth without the crucifixion, what is he? I don't want to say anything bad about that, but Christ without the crucifixion is not complete. And it strengthens us. This tested genuineness of our faith, without it being tested, our faith isn't genuine. God may know, but do I? And so I can ride a pew all along, but without the testing, I won't even know my own self. Have you noticed verses 10 and 11 having a difference in them? In verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted. Verse 11, blessed are you. And it moves from this beautiful, theoretical, wonderful treatise in verses 3 through 10. Blessed are those, and we can sit in our formal wear, and we can talk about these things, and we can talk about them at a distance, and make this a very comfortable sermon, because these demands and these ideas are held at a distance. And then he says in verse 11, blessed are you. And all of a sudden, we're ripped open, and we have to see that blessed are the meek needs to be in me. And blessed are you when you are persecuted for my sake. When Jesus said this, Jesus was just a guy who was a prophet and performing miracles. Now, he was the Son of God, but imagine that audience not knowing full. And he said, guys, blessed are you when you get beat up because of me, he says. That's a big deal. This is how kingdom citizens live and suffer. Our psalm to close is verses 13 through 16. Salt and light. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. You need to take the time to write your sermon for those two little bits. They're really powerful. If we're salt, then we must be salt. We must be sal. We must be salt. That's what we are, and we've got to do it. And if we are salt that aren't salt, then what are we? We're not salt. We just aren't. And if we're lights, we will be seen. If we're not seen, we're not lights. And so we are this way. And we are this way every single day. And coming back to look at these Beatitudes, coming back to look at these ideals and these teachings of who I need to be and who you individually need to be, this is what we need to do. Blessed are the. See if you can pick one that you memorize. If it's your favorite, memorize them all if you can. And start thinking about them, trying to make them a part of your life, a part of your year this year. I hope that this is an encouragement to you. I always enjoy studying and think about it myself. I don't know what your state is in this moment. It's a new year. Maybe you need to make it a new you. Jesus can help you be that way. change, be washed. If there's anyone who needs to be baptized, we have the waters here ready for you. If anyone needs prayers, why don't you come and let us know as we stand together and sing.